I am Bill Radke. Covering the news today, we're still talking about deadlines because there's a deadline today for the residents of the jungle to leave. You know about the homeless encampment under I-5. Today is the day city and state officials are clearing it out. KUOW's growth and development reporter Joshua McNichols was there this morning telling us what clearing out the jungle means.
They tagged all the tents and they told them, you have to be out by this date because we're going to finally clear it. And what that means is, social workers are going to come in and they're, you know, this really intense, this is it, you got to move. And then they're sorting through the belongings that are left behind. They're saying, okay, this is somebody's belongings. We're going to keep it in a plastic container for them to come get later. And this is garbage and we're going to throw it away. Or if it's hypodermic needles, they're going to gather them in gallon jars and take them to a hazmat facility. And we've seen evidence that, you know, this deadline is working. We've seen people picking through their own stuff and deciding what they're going to take with them. And we've seen people leaving.
How are people there reacting to this move out?
Oh, they're frustrated and defiant. Defiant, but they're saying, look, we're just going to go somewhere else. There was a guy who was camping underneath the Spokane Street Viaduct who said, hey, you can come down and camp by me. So they're just going to move somewhere else. Union Gospel Mission says they managed to get 25% of the people they reached out to into housing or shelter or another camp. But that leaves 75% of people here that just went somewhere else or are going to go somewhere else. Most of them are gone. There's only supposedly about 13 people left, maybe a little bit more than that. But, you know, there's not a lot left here.
Is there anyone there protesting or even trying to prevent this clear out?
Yeah, there were a couple of groups here. Stop the Sweeps is one protest group. And then the Tent City Collective, which is mostly UW students, were also here. They were here with signs to disrupt the press conference where the city and state were announcing this morning. But they've pretty much dispersed now. They say that really their effort is to shine a light on the sweep. They're upset with sweeps in general, and they're focusing their efforts on, you know, legislation in the city council that will prevent sweeps from a lot of different public spaces. And also, Shama Sawant sent one of her aides down, and they were talking about putting money into housing instead of, for example, the North Police Precinct, which they think is tied to this jungle sweep here.
Finally, Joshua, while the city is clearing or sweeping the jungle, meanwhile, the city's considering officially letting people camp in some parks and sidewalks. What's the connection?
Well, this is state land here, and the state doesn't want people on this land, and they say they need to do maintenance under the I-5 bridge. This is an elevated structure. It's got expansion joints. And they claim that that is the reason why they have to get people out from under here. With parks, that's sort of the city's decision about what to do there. These are two different jurisdictions who ultimately have different constituencies to answer to. So they're treating encampments differently.
KUOW's growth and development reporter Joshua McNichols. Thanks, Joshua.
Thank you.
You're listening to KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Also in the news today, the idea of keeping guns away from people in crisis is very much at the front of our minds because there is an initiative coming to your fall ballot. This is Initiative 1491, and it would let judges grant an extreme risk protection order that would remove somebody's guns for up to a year. Opponents say this measure unfairly stigmatizes people with mental illness. KUOW's Amy Radel has the story for you.
Marilyn Balsarak is the citizen sponsor of Initiative 1491. Under the measure, law enforcement, families, and household members could seek to remove someone's guns if they're deemed to pose a risk to themselves or others.
With my youngest son, James, it did become apparent, especially the year before the tragedy, that he was on a downhill spiral.
James was in his early 20s. He had autism, and Balsarak's longtime partner, Matt Smith, says James seemed to be in deep despair, upset at not having the life he wanted.
It was never, I hate life, and I want to take my own life. It's, I want to be a successful adult like my older brothers are, like you are. And I lost hope.
He made clear during an argument that he was thinking of suicide.
When I was on the phone with 911, he was screaming through the door, yes or no, can I commit suicide? Yes or no, I'll give you 10 seconds.
Balsarac and Smith worried about James getting a gun, but they feared that seeking to have him committed or getting a restraining order would sever ties with him completely. Then a man killed six people near UC Santa Barbara in 2014, and Balsarac says she saw parallels with James's problems.
I was afraid he would go to Bellevue College because he did struggle so much there socially.
So she asked him.
I said at that time, "Are you thinking about killing yourself?" And he said, "No, not today." And I asked him, "Are you thinking about hurting anybody else?" And he looked at me and he said, "Why would you even ask me that question?"
Balsarac says if extreme risk protection orders had been in place, she would have sought one to prevent James from obtaining a gun. If a judge grants the order, it can remain in effect for up to a year. But ultimately, James bought a gun at the Fred Meyer store in Kent. He shot his stepsister, Brianna Smith, and then himself at the family's home in Auburn. That day changed everything. They left their house and never returned, except to retrieve their cats. Smith has worked for the same aerospace supplier in Renton for decades. The company closed so the entire staff could attend James and Brianna's memorial services. Smith says his colleagues are compassionate people, but many are gun owners and advocates, and they disagree with the political campaign he's joined.
They have a strong belief that they will defend themselves and they will prevent any harm from ever happening to them because they have access to a firearm. As someone now that is a survivor, and I always say I'm not a survivor, I'm surviving gun tragedy every day. I pray that they never have this experience.
One of the most visible opponents to the initiative is David Combs, who does not own guns and has no office or staff. He does interviews from the lobby of his Redmond condo. He's worried that the language in this initiative stigmatizes people with mental illness.
I have bipolar disorder, which is interesting enough, by definition, a severe mental illness, which is in the initiative, one of the criteria that can be used by the judge for issuing the extreme risk protection court order, which was one of my concerns when I read the initiative.
Combs is an advocate and support group facilitator for people with mental illness. He's worried that just having certain conditions would be grounds for granting these orders.
The use of a illness as a criteria, as opposed to behaviors, is concerning.
People with mental illness can be at higher risk for suicide, but have not been found at higher risk of harming others. Combs says the initiative could have been better written, but he worries that voters may not care.
I think people have so much fear around firearms that they just want to have a solution.
Another issue for opponents is the fact that temporary protection orders can be granted without the person being notified or present. Lars Daleside is a spokesperson for the National Rifle Association.
The main problem the NRA has with 1491 is that it would strip law-abiding citizens of their constitutional rights without even entering a courtroom.
The NRA is not spending money to oppose the initiative, but Daleside says they are trying to get the word out to their members not to vote for it.
We've been giving them updates. We're telling them why they should oppose this initiative. And hopefully with a good showing on Election Day, it will be defeated.
Local Second Amendment activist Alan Gottlieb told the Seattle Times his group is also not spending money to oppose 1491. Instead, he says they'll put money into state legislative races and challenging the measure in court if it passes. The campaign to pass Initiative 1491 has raised $3.7 million so far. It's sponsored by the Alliance for Gun Responsibility, which last year successfully passed an expansion of firearm background checks. I'm Amy Radel, KUOW News.
And one more thing, you know, if somebody you know or if you are considering suicide, please call the National Suicide Hotline. The number is 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8255. This is KUOW's The Record. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Let's get back to the news coverage now. More than $1 million. That is how much the Service Employees International Union has invested in trying to help Democrats win control of the state legislature this year. And that makes SEIU the single biggest donor on the Democratic side. And what does the union want in return for its investment? Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins reports in collaboration with the Seattle Times.
If there's a messiah in Washington State's labor movement these days, it's a guy named David Rolfe.
Here's the deal. America was not always a low-wage nation.
That was Rolfe addressing Seattle's town hall earlier this year. He just published a book on the fight for a $15 an hour minimum wage. Rolfe has also partnered with billionaire Nick Hanauer to promote the concept of portable benefits for a 21st century workforce. But it's Rolfe's day job that makes him a power player in Washington politics. He's the president of SEIU 775. That's a union that represents some 43,000 home care workers in Washington.
It used to be considered sort of an invisible, paraprofessional, poverty-stricken workforce.
Not anymore. Let me give you a little history. Back in 2001, Washington voters approved an SEIU-funded initiative to allow home care workers to unionize. Since then, the union has won higher wages and recently even a retirement package. This summer, the union negotiated a new contract with the state to give home care workers a $15 an hour base wage by 2019. And that's where the 2016 elections start to factor in. You see, lawmakers still need to ratify and fund that contract.
What's at stake for home care and nursing home workers is whether some of the gains they've experienced over the last decade and a half are safe or at risk.
So why might they be at risk? Because for the first time in nearly 20 years, Republicans have a chance to take control of the Washington House. Rolfe doesn't want that to happen, out of concern that Republicans might not fund his members' new contract, but also because he views a Democratic House as a backstop now that the state Senate is in GOP hands.
It's always been able to prevent anything really bad from happening when it comes to workers' rights or worker benefits. At times, they've been able to help move the ball forward.
Now, so far this year, Rolfe's union, other SEIU locals, and the state council for SEIU have contributed nearly $600,000 to help House Democrats retain control. They've also contributed more than $300,000 to help Senate Democrats try to win back the majority. Republicans say if you want to see what concentrated influence looks like in Washington state, look no further than SEIU.
They have grown into a very large political powerhouse.
So that's Kevin Carnes. He heads the House Republicans' campaign efforts, and he insists that SEIU has a hidden agenda.
What they're really looking to do is buy a caucus and get an income tax. They're looking for outcomes.
An income tax? Well, in 2010, SEIU did back a failed initiative to enact an income tax on high earners in Washington. But SEIU's David Rolfe denies there's a secret plan with Democrats to institute a state income tax. He does, however, say there's a growing list of unmet needs and the state should be looking for new sources of revenue, including a capital gains tax.
If there are revenue sources and the votes are there for them, then we ought to look at that.
Someone else who says there's no secret income tax plan? Democratic Speaker of the House Frank Chop.
No way. In fact, the people of the state have also spoken very strongly against that particular idea, and that's simply not on the table anywhere in the legislature.
Chop says there's another reason why his caucus is getting so much SEIU money.
We strongly support extending and expanding health care for people. That includes home care for the elderly and disabled in their home so they don't have to go into a nursing home. We have a long history of that. The Republicans don't.
Now, SEIU home care workers have endorsed several individual Republican candidates this year and have a tradition of doing so, but Union President David Rolfe says the main focus this year is on electing what he calls pro-worker majorities in the state legislature. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
This is KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information, and tomorrow we're going to look at a pair of wealthy individual donors to Republican campaign coffers this year. Thank you for tuning in today. I'm Bill Radke. Donald Trump today has been issuing a series of tweets criticizing House Speaker Paul Ryan for effectively abandoning the Trump campaign here just weeks before Election Day. Ryan, as you know, backed away from the Republican nominee after a recording surfaced of Trump bragging about groping women. Other Republicans have said they won't even vote for Trump, but the National Federation of Republican Women is sticking by the candidate. Eileen Sobjak is an officer with that organization. She lives in Whatcom County, and she joins us live now. Eileen, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Donald Trump said his candid comments about women was just locker room talk. Others say he was bragging about sexual assault. How do you see it?
Well, this is the way I see it. He came out and he apologized for his remarks, and I accept that apology, and I take into account that it was 11 years ago. And I have to tell you, it's a lot more than Hillary Clinton has not apologized for Benghazi or deleted emails and many other things. And she offers only excuses. And I believe actions speak louder than words.
And you're talking about Hillary Clinton's work as Secretary of State.
Yes.
And so that's on the policy side, the political side. I wonder, could Donald Trump say anything in his personal life that would cost him your support? Do you completely separate personal life from politics?
Well, I have to admit that, of course, I was shocked initially when I heard these comments. But like I said, he's apologized for them, and I am moving on. I believe Donald Trump is going to defend our Constitution. He's going to uphold conservative principles, and he vows to nominate a Supreme Court justice that will be representative of Justice Scalia, repeal and replace Obamacare, and increase jobs and the economy. Those are important issues to me. They're very important to America.
As you've said, Donald Trump has apologized, and would you give the same pass to any politician who's apologized? How do you feel about Bill Clinton's personal life?
Well, I have not heard Bill Clinton apologize. And
If he did, he wouldn't be disqualified for president.
I beg your pardon?
If Bill Clinton apologized to your satisfaction, he would not be disqualified.
Well, he's not running for president, and he was impeached as a president. So that, to me, is in the past. You know, I'm moving forward with this election season that we're in right now, and it's about Hillary Clinton, not about Bill Clinton.
Susan Hutchison said that Trump was a Democrat at the time he made those remarks, and that he was channeling Bill Clinton. And she got criticized by a lot of even Republicans for saying that. What was your take?
I support Susan Hutchison as a chair, and I'm supporting our Republican candidates. And I'm not going to be nitpicky about, you know, how a quote comes across on the radio or the TV. We need to stand together and united and elect our Republicans out. And that was the message from the National Federation of Republican Women, that we may disagree on issues, but we do believe in conservative principles as Republicans, and we need to support all of our Republican candidates from the top of the ticket to the bottom.
What would you say to those GOP members who even publicly pulled their support from Trump, Congresswoman Jamie Herrera Butler, Republican of Southwest Washington, saying she's going to be writing in the name Paul Ryan instead of voting for Donald Trump?
You know, I'm sure there historically there have been other times where Republicans have quietly voted not for the Republican nominee in all different offices. But I don't recall a time where we have had such a focus on asking Republicans that are running for office how they're voting. I understand, you know, that we want to understand, are they supporting Trump? The media wants to understand this. But I just have respect for my Republican friends. We're going to get through this election, do the best we can, and we're going to move forward after it. And I'm not going to get into battles. There's just too much work to be done for our country. And the American people are depending on us electing someone that's going to take us in the right direction. And I believe Donald Trump is that person.
Finally, Eileen, you're with the National Federation of Republican Women. Your organization works to empower women in the political process and set them up to serve as leaders. How does this candidate, Donald Trump, empower women?
Well, I've talked to some of the women that have been in business with Donald Trump, and I've heard some amazing stories. He is a man that appreciates smart, gifted, talented women. And he has many women that he's put in places of leadership, and he respects those women. And yeah, that's what I have seen and heard from women that have worked with Donald Trump.
Eileen Sobjak of Whatcom County is an officer with the National Federation of Republican Women. Eileen, thanks for talking with us on KUOW.
All right. Thank you very much.
Donald Trump today said that House Speaker Paul Ryan has given him zero support, and Trump said that Democrats are far more loyal to each other than Republicans. And finally, Trump declared that the shackles have been taken off him in this campaign. We'll continue to cover this election for you right here on listener-supported KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. The record continues. Now back to the news on listener-supported KUOW. It is now four public high school football teams that have forfeited their games against Archbishop Murphy, the Everett Catholic School. Four schools in a row have pulled out of their games, saying that Archbishop Murphy has players that are, quote, dangerously large. Other people say those public schools just don't want to lose by a lot, which has been happening lately. I talked with the football coach at Clahoya Public High School in Silverdale, and Dan Erickson said the real problem is not the size of Archbishop Murphy's players. It's that public schools like his have to play private schools that have big advantages.
At a public school, we work with who we have, but I cannot go out and promote my football program or my school to other schools or youth sports. If I'm a private school, I can go and promote to whomever I really want to.
Now we're talking about recruitment.
I mean, that's legal.
What's this public-private situation like across other sports?
Here's one example. Our girls' soccer team has been quite successful with two state championships in the 18-year history of the school. I believe Clahoya was one of only two public schools that were on that state championship trophy for girls soccer. The rest were all private schools. That went back, I think it went back into the late 80s.
What is this all about to you?
Equitable playing field. I think everybody wants their children to have a chance to do well, obviously, but the playing field needs to be leveled out.
How do you feel about the fact that suddenly this is on everybody's lips? We're talking about public, private, recruitment, what's fair and not. How do you feel about the conversation we're having about high school football right now?
I think it's healthy. Again, the forfeits are not healthy, but the fact that people are talking about it and realizing that it's not a level playing field and maybe something needs to be done about it, I think action will follow on the state level.
What do you predict?
I predict that we will have some separation of public and private schools, at least in the postseason.
Why do you suppose that public-private split hasn't happened in Washington State before now?
I can't answer that, but I've been a coach of various high school sports for 16 years, as long as I've been a teacher. It's always been an issue. Coaches have always talked about it. Whether it's just, you know, coach to coach, or it's always been an issue of the public schools wishing that they didn't have to play the private schools. And it seems like everybody has a private school that goes against them and is dominant. So it's always been an issue. I don't know why it hasn't come up.
To someone who's not really into this high school sports world, they may think, okay, public, private, split them up. I don't know why we didn't do it before. What's the problem?
Yeah, I think there's might be a lot of people that say, yeah, that's a no-brainer. Split them up.
So what am I missing? What's the backlash going to be against that idea?
I would imagine as a private school, right now they can have a private school champion at every classification. So maybe if it went to a system where they were all competing against them, each other, there is only going to be one private school champion for a sport. Off the top of my head, you throw Bellarmine Prep, O'Day, Eastside Catholic, Cascade Christian, Kings, all in the Archbishop Murphy, all in the same tournament bracket. That is some of the best athletic competition that you could put together in the state of Washington.
Dan Erickson is a football coach at Clahoya High School in Silverdale, a public school. Four public high school teams in a row now have forfeited games against the Everett Catholic School Archbishop Murphy. This latest forfeit this week means that Archbishop Murphy will have no homecoming game this year. Thanks for supporting KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. I'm glad you're able to listen to us now. When you turn away from audio and it's time to open up a book, maybe you could use a little guidance. So we have Nancy Pearl back with KUOW arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman. Here's a recommendation.
Nancy Pearl, welcome back to KUOW.
Thank you, Marcy. It's great to be here as always.
We were speaking most recently about fall being really the time where those of us who live for that pile of books get very excited. And adding to our pile, what did you bring in today?
Well, today I brought a novel called Orphans of the Carnival. It's by a writer, Carol Birch. I had never read anything by her. One of her earlier novels was longlisted for the Booker Prize, the Man Booker Prize, Britain's biggest literary award. I have to say, I just thought this book was pretty magnificent, but it's not an easy read. It's told from the perspective, or it's about two different women who live about a century apart. The one who is the most interesting to me, I think, was a woman named Julia, who is one of the attractions in freak shows. And she is someone who has a beautiful voice, a beautiful singing voice, but many people think that she's the missing link between humans and apes because she is covered with hair.
Oh, my.
And we as readers follow along as she is discovered when she is working in Mexico, where she's born, and then brought to the United States and then put on stage to entertain people. Okay. It's the writing. It's Carol Birch's writing that carries the novel, absolutely. The contemporary young woman is someone who is having trouble living the life that she's living. I mean, she's someone who doesn't really fit in to her own body, to her own experiences. And how these two women are connected, what connects them, is really slowly, slowly, slowly revealed through the book.
I wrote down very quickly, you said this book is magnificent but not an easy read. What do you mean when you say not an easy read?
Yeah, it could mean a couple of things. I think for me, one is that it deals with topics that I have a strong emotional response to. So that's one thing. And when I say it's not an easy read, that's what I'm really talking about, is the topics. So there's, you know, a lot of nonfiction that I feel like I ought to read, but I just have to be in the right place to do it.
There are also novels that are not an easy read, and I'm sure somebody will leap up and start yelling at the radio right now, but the books that David Foster Wallace wrote in his lifetime with the voluminous footnotes, I found that physically difficult to read.
No, this is not that kind of book, but I have to say that I love those footnotes of David Foster Wallace's. I love them in his essays. I love them in his novels. I think that I'm a footnote kind of gal. And you are not.
And I am not. But there's no footnotes in Orphans
no,
of the Carnival.
They're just two very interesting, very different, and yet subtly connected women.
Again, that book is Orphans of the Carnival by Carol Birch. Nancy Pearl talked about it with KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Sillman. And you'll find all of Nancy's book picks at our website, KUOW.org.